Hello, my name is Christopher Kakuyo Sensei, and I am the practice leader of the Salt Lake Buddhist Fellowship. Our fellowship is made up of folks from all walks of American life. We are an American Buddhist Sangha. Our fellowship is lay-led, all-inclusive, non-discriminating, and trans-sectarian Sangha, influenced by the Pure Land Buddhist tradition and the teachings of Gyomei and Koyo Kobose. Our organization focuses on the universal teachings of Gautama Buddha, the historical Buddha, and the mythic Buddha Amida. Our approach follows the teachings of the Way of Oneness, a unique form of American Buddhism developed by Venerable Reverend Gyomei Kobose, based on Shin Buddhist tenets. What you are about to hear are some Dharma talks from our local fellowship gatherings. Enjoy the Dharma Talk. I want to start my Dharma Talk with Chapter 32 from the Diamond Sutra. Here at Buddha has just finished his daily walking meditation in a garden in a town called Sarvasti. And they're gathered together, sharing the offerings of food that were given to them. It's important to remember that the Buddha and his monks were utterly dependent on others to feed them, to clothe them, to help them when they were sick. So they're sitting around, they're just finishing their meal, and the monks have gathered around the Buddha. And one of his students asks the Buddha, How, Lord, should one who set out on the Bodhisattva path take his stand? How should he proceed? How should he control his mind? And in the 32nd chapter of the Diamond Sutra is the Buddha's answer to that question. So for today's Dharma talk, I want to start at that 32nd chapter, because the Buddha basically says the answer to Subhuti's question on how to proceed on the Bodhisattva path is to realize the impermanence of our conditioned existence. From the Diamond Sutra. Quote, so I say to you, this is how to contemplate our conditioned existence in this fleeting world. Like a tiny drop of dew or a bubble floating in a stream, like a flash of lightning in a summer cloud, or a flickering lamp, an illusion, a phantom, or a dream, so is all conditioned existence to be seen. Thus spoke the Buddha. I love that the Buddha distills all 32 chapters of this sutra into one poem. And why a poem? Why this poem? I want to share a few different translations of the same poem from different translators. This one is from Red Pine. As a lamp, a cataract, a star in space, an illusion, a dewdrop, a bubble, a dream, a cloud, a flash of lightning. View all created things like this. And another translation from Thich Nhat Hanh. All composed things are like a dream, a phantom, a drop of dew, a flash of lightning. That is how to meditate on them. That is how to observe them. Now, I've loved these lines for a long time, and they've always had an impact on me. In another sutra, the Buddha teaches us the following, quote, just as a dewdrop on the tip of a blade of grass quickly banishes with the rising of the sun and does not stay long. In the same way, Brahmins, the life of human beings is like a dewdrop." End quote. For those who are a little bit longer in years, and we look back on our lives, we really understand this teaching more and more on how fast it goes. There is something bittersweet in these images, a deep truth about the transient nature of all things. One of the three marks or core teachings of pretty much every Buddhist school, whether Tibetan, Chinese, Indian, Thai, or American, is the truth of impermanence, called anicca or anicca. It is the teaching that everything changes and nothing lasts forever. Nothing. That is why most of us engage with the teaching only superficially. And I know I have for a long time. And you want to ask why? Well, let's go back to the Diamond Sutra, chapter 32. Remember the first line from the poem. This is how to contemplate our conditioned existence in this fleeting world. And then the last line. So is all conditioned existence to be seen. So at the heart of the teaching of impermanence is conditioned existence. But what is conditioned existence? Conditioned existence is the reality that all phenomena, all things exist, arise out of the dependence upon other phenomena. If this exists, that exists. If this ceases to exist, that also ceases to exist. This is the heart of impermanence, of all, because all things, all phenomena arise out of causes and conditions. And when the conditions or causes that made it arise cease, then that which arose vanishes or transforms into something different. That is why the Buddha says, quote, "All conditioned things have the nature of vanishing." Let that sink in. Everything by its nature vanishes. In Japanese, the heartbreak, the melancholy of that reality, of that vanishing, of the impermanence of all things can be summed up in one phrase, mono no aware. Mono no aware cannot be truly translated into English, as those who speak another language understand there are certain words you just can't translate into another language. Pathos, the feeling, the deep feeling of mono no aware doesn't really have the capacity to translate it into English. But we can do our vain attempt. And the vain attempt of it translated into English is the ah-ness of things, the is-ness of things, or the bitter, sweet poignancy of things. I remember some years ago reading an introduction from one of my favorite poets who writes in Portuguese. His name is Eugenio de Andrade. And the poet writes that from his love of this world and the grief and praise that comes from its transience, something that makes the world beautiful is its nature to vanish. And this idea that grief and praise are one and the same is something that I've been learning of late from Martin Prechtel in his book, The Smell of Rain on Dust. Another integral part of gratitude is an awareness of impermanence. The concept of mono no aware is born from the teaching of Shinto and Buddhism and was first used to explain aesthetics, to explain such traditions as cherry blossom viewing and moon viewing and haiku. But this insight is much more than simply aesthetics. Mono no aware is at the heart of a meaningful everyday Buddhism. Understanding and embodying impermanence can only happen in our everyday lives when we can slowly begin to recognize and allow ourselves to experience grief and praise in the impermanence of everything that exists. Now, what we're talking about, this understanding of impermanence, I think all of us are in a place where we can say, yeah, I know things die. Yes, I know I will die. And some of us who are very more atheistic on the spectrum or say, I'm going to be worm food. Those who may be more mythological may believe in life after death, but we still all know that this existence, this arcane, it's done. Okay? And yet we don't live that way. We don't live in the reality of our impermanence. This is so much more than just knowing scientifically or cognitively that things come and go. It's more visceral. My knowing that I'm going to die has not changed anything I do. I smoked for over 30 years. I'm not more grateful, more patient, more understanding because I know I'm going to die, because I haven't embodied that understanding. I haven't really allowed myself to feel it. Knowing impermanence, understanding impermanence from a cognitive level is a beginning, but generally, it does not change who we are. In the words of Saint Bodhisattva Charles Bukowski, he says, I am terrorized by trivialities. How many of us are terrorized by trivialities? He goes on to say, we're all going to die, all of us. What a circus. That alone should make us love each other, but it doesn't. We are terrorized and flattened by trivialities. We are eaten up by nothing. End quote. So in a way, the Buddha is inviting all of us to love each other by letting go of all our grasping and by embodying impermanence. When he is sitting around those monks in that garden, telling Subhuti how to contemplate conditioned existence in this fleeting world, he is teaching him something that is liberatory. Quote, like a tiny dewdrop or a bubble floating in a stream. I'll visualize this, am I reading it? Like a flash of lightning in a summer cloud or a flickering lamp, an illusion, a phantom, a dream. In the end, so many of our disappointments and travails are for naught. The Buddha understood this. In Dharma Breeze by Nobuo Haneda, he teaches us this, quote, although the basic nature of the self is impermanence, Shakyamuni was attached to the self. He considered it permanent and desired to maintain it against the truth. The negative aspect of the truth of impermanence initially appeared to Shakyamuni as a negative force, old age, sickness, and death. But when Shakyamuni understood absolute impermanence, he recognized his mistake. Now he totally identified with the truth of impermanence and loosened his grip on the self. In the Buddha's awakening experience, he discovered that at the heart of reality was anicca, impermanence, emptiness, this constant arising and fading, appearing and vanishing, this state of constantly becoming, as Guillaume Cabossi so beautifully puts it. The Buddha did not become the Buddha until he embodied, he lived a life of impermanence, of continuous becoming. Realizing this, the Buddha has invited us to begin to recognize and allow ourselves to experience the impermanence of everything that exists. And by doing so, start to cultivate a deeper and more intimate connection with it. Because of this fleeting nature and deeper gratitude for the experiencing of it all, our journey as individuals and as a community begins by coming intimate with the sorrow and the joy that can be found in impermanence. The poem and poetry are important in expressing the profound teaching. Metaphor is important for expressing a profound teaching to go beyond the simple cognitive acceptance of death. We can say all day long that we know we're going to die someday, or that we embrace the teaching of impermanence. But do we really? A cognitive assent to its reality is not what the Buddha is teaching us. It's not what he's inviting us to delve into, but a deeper, more visceral understanding. I can say that I understand the idea of impermanence, that everything changes all the time, yet I am devastated at the end of a love affair or a marriage, disappointed and vexed when a friend betrays me, or troubled when my health fails. I know we all die, but dying is something that happens to other people. I think that's why one of the traditional practices is to recite the five remembrances every morning, as they do in many Zen communities. The five remembrances are as follows. One, I am by nature to grow old. There is no way to escape growing old. I am of the nature to have ill health. There is no way to escape having ill health. I am of the nature to die. There is no way to escape death. All that is dear to me and everyone I love are of the nature to change. There is no way to escape being separated from them. My actions are my only true belongings. I cannot escape the consequence of my actions. My actions, my deeds, are the ground upon which I stand. Now, the thought of starting every morning with those five remembrances, woo! Wow. Let's start on a positive note. Come on, let's be positive. We're going to do it. We're going to do this day. Come on. Give me five. But there's a reason. Because the nature of our ego self, our small ego self, in all his stories is just stories. The self that we hold on so tightly to is really empty of any substance. For the most part, it's just a conglomeration of stories. that story, it wants to be positive, because when we start to realize the five remembrances, then we start to see the world as it really is, and the trivialities that make the ego important now seem less important. All of a sudden, those stories that the small self lives for dissolve because of the nature of life, how it really is. I remember years ago reading the teachings of Dogen, the father of Japanese Zen Buddhism, and they ran across these lines. And he said, impermanence is itself Buddha nature. Impermanence itself is Buddha nature. I didn't like that at all. I like Buddha nature, you know, this kind of fluffy Buddha nature, where I got this like really cool superhero Buddha inside me. And I just got to like uncover the dust, and the superhero Buddha is going to come out, and I'm going to be super compassionate, loving, and kind, and not vexed by anything. And then Dogen says, well, no, it's just impermanence. You're going to die. That's what makes you Buddha nature. The fact that you are born out of causes and conditions, that's Buddha nature. I didn't like that. And I remember, actually, I don't remember if I threw the book across the room. Screw that. Or just threw it on the ground. Usually when you read something and you throw it on the ground, there's a teaching. See why you put the book down. See why you threw it across the room. Something's challenging you. Intellectually, I have no issues with impermanence. But emotionally, also, if anybody has some abandonment issues, impermanence is a rough one. Impermanence was difficult. I think for me, part of my resistance to impermanence is hidden and unresolved grief. I think that part of embracing impermanence, I think about that all the time. We tend to think spirituality is something that brings us peace and joy. But to get to peace and joy, we have to travel through grief. I think one of the hardest part of living with impermanence is its natural companion. What's the natural companion with impermanence? It's grief. When we intellectually accept all things are going to die, we're separating it from our heart. We tend to separate it from our body. It's all in here. It's in here. It protects us from feeling and being transformed by impermanence, because it's a concept. It's an idea. I love this poem from Kodo Sawaki Roshi. Kodo Sawaki Roshi was called the homeless Kodo, the homeless teacher. And he literally was homeless in Japan. And he was homeless for 30 years. He never had a temple. He never had a school. But he was well known all over Japan as an awakened teacher. He says this: from insentient beings such as grasses and trees wither today, seeing them in front of their eyes, how can people be without grieving? End quote. Here is a master who's watching grass die, who understands the impermanence of all things, and still says, how, when seeing that, does one not grieve? I think that's the problem we have as Westerners. As Westerners, we don't have rituals of grief. Matter of fact, in many of our traditions, our Judeo-Christian traditions, to have grief shows a lack of faith, or shows there's something wrong with you if you grieve too much, or if your grief is inappropriate. Unlike the beautiful wailing in Islamic communities, when someone close dies and they wail. And for us as Westerners, we're uncomfortable with that. Feeling and embracing the grief of impermanence is part of the Buddhist path. It is being a realized human being. Our come as you are invitation is also for grief. We learn from Akamura Roshi that Dogen's path to the Dharma began in the grief of seeing the incense smoke at his mother's funeral. Why did that move me? That moved me to tears just now. That smoke just rising. And for Dogen, that image, that moment in the grief of his mother's death and the incense smoke rising, directed the rest of his life. And we learn from the Jodo Shin priest, Isa, a haiku that the master wrote in the 18th century after the death of his third child. This world of dew is a world of dew. And yet. Basho, the haiku master, writes about returning to his hometown many years after he left. He writes in his journal, quote, "Nothing remained the same in my native village. Even the faces of my brothers had changed with wrinkles and white hair, and we simply rejoiced to see each other alive." End quote. Basho's elder brother takes out a small amulet bag, opens it, and says, "See your mother's frosty hairs." After weeping for a few moments, Basho composes a haiku, which he wrote, "Should I hold them in my hand, they will disappear in the warmth of my tears, icy strings of frost." There is nothing in the Buddhist path that guarantees you will feel better following the teachings of the Buddha. But one thing is guaranteed: you will feel more joy and more sadness, more praise and more grief. Being present with yourself, maybe for the first time in your life, you are going to start feeling all those things you've hidden away in stories. I'd like to say that if you ain't crying, you ain't trying. In Reverend Guillaume Cabose's book, The Center Within, he shares a story about a man who lost his beloved wife, who thinks of her all the time. They were together 50 years, and he's overcome with sadness. He tells Sensei that he understands the teaching of non-attachment and impermanence, and he asks Reverend Guillaume, "Why am I crying? I am a bad Buddhist because I can't let go and I'm so sad. Is crying bad, Sensei?" And this is a great question. Sometimes Buddhists, we do a thing called spiritual bypassing. And that's when we don't feel something because we think we shouldn't feel it because now I'm Buddhist. Or now I'm mindful, so I shouldn't be feeling this way. Or now I'm aspiring to compassion. Why do I hate them so much? He asks, "Is crying bad, Sensei? Am I a bad Buddhist?" We cannot use the teachings not to feel something because we as Buddhists are supposed to let go. We try to be a good Buddhist. In reality, we can only let go. There is no such thing as a good Buddhist or a bad Buddhist. There is only those that are on the path. We try to be good Buddhists. In reality, we can't truly let go until we experience our grief and our loss. And last Sunday, our goodness or our need to be good, to be accepted or loved. Reverend Guillaume puts his arm around the grieving man and says to him, "Your wife was very dear to you. She meant so much to you. Non-attachment does not mean detachment. When you cry, cry. Tears are often beautiful. Your trouble is not with your wife, but your attachment to non-attachment." End quote. Shinran Shonen, the father of Jodo Shinshu, taught that we should not criticize those lamenting in sadness. When you are sad, you do not have to hold back your tears. It's okay to grieve. Shinran actually said, "Take your friend and a bottle of sake and console each other." For us to embrace and embody impermanence, the first step is to grieve impermanence. It's okay to be sad that shit goes away. It's okay to be brokenhearted that things have a tendency to vanish. Doesn't make you a bad Buddhist, because that makes you sad and makes you more human. As Isa has written in another haiku, "Tears of sadness themselves naturally turn into compassion." Tears of sadness themselves naturally turn into compassion. I think our first steps as we contemplate conditioned existence is to become intimate with impermanence, is to allow grief to enter our experience. As the writer Francis Reller has written, quote, "The work of the mature person is to carry grief in one hand and gratitude in the other, and to be stretched large by them." End quote. To feel the words that all things by their nature vanish, it is by experiencing the grief of impermanence that we can allow it to seep into our bones. All those years ago, when the Buddha was in travesty with his monks, he knew that by embracing impermanence, we could finally be free. Free of expectation and trivialities. Free of story and free of reactivity. Free of all the suffering that comes from so much knowing of how the world is supposed to be and grasping at the illusion of permanence. I want to share these words on Mono no Aware from the writers at the Berkeley Center of Religion and Culture. In writing about Mono no Aware, they write, "It boils down to this: appreciate the moment, because the beauty experienced in it will never be the same. It will pass, it will end, and that is okay. Because as life changes, new beauty, perhaps a different kind, will arrive. Every season, the cherry blossoms die, but every year they come back to, once again, coat the streets in their ethereal and incomparable demise." And in the morning, one of my favorite things in the morning is my oldest, Teague, tends to wake up first, and he'll come looking for me through the house. He'll come and he'll sit on my lap, and I'll hold him in my lap, and I'll bury my nose in his neck, and I'll breathe him in, and I'll tell him how much I love him every morning, because going to change. I won't always be there. So in that moment is eternal. And I am filled with such gratitude and the reality that it will not be here again. Once we embody impermanence, we can then truly be present in our lives as they unfold in a way that we've never been before. On the other side of the grief of impermanence is a deep and profound gratitude for the very fact that we are alive and experiencing this thing called awareness and consciousness. And maybe as we cultivate our practice, maybe we can see in a deeper way all the grace that attends us every day and everything that supports us. And I hope that in the end, that we can truly say, as Kurt Vonnegut wrote in Slaughterhouse-Five, quote, "And I was some of the mud that got to sit up and look around. Lucky me, lucky mud." So my aspiration for all of us and for myself included is that we allow ourselves to embody impermanence and we take those first steps. And those first steps is to do what the Buddha asks. Contemplate. Meditation is not just about breathing in and breathing out. It's not just about noticing the beautiful flower or the butterfly. It's part of it, but it's also contemplation. It's like thinking that this life, it's like a flash of lightning in a summer cloud. That's what our life is like. Allow metaphor, allow image to seep into us so we can start to realize that's more than a concept and start to really appreciate that which we have in the moment because it's in the moment. It's right here. So before it vanishes, give it a kiss. Give it a hug. Sniff its neck, scratch its belly, and say, thank you, thank you, thank you. Namo Amida Butsu.
Namo Amida Butsu. Buddhaya Dharmaya Sangha.